Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 3:11 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is May 3rd, and I thought that I would kick off today with the 10-year Treasury yield. It's down to 3.35%. It hasn't quite broken lower yet, but it is below the psychological 3.5% level and below the 200-day moving average as well. And I think that there's significant room for additional compression. So we had the Federal Reserve raise interest rates today by a quarter of a percent. And then you had Jay Powell in the conference call after the decision, basically saying that there's a good chance that they're going to pause here, but that they're going to remain sensitive to incoming data. They may yet raise rates again, but they're certainly not going to cut rates, and they want to hold rates higher for longer in order to see how things pan out. So there are, I think, lots of moving parts and things that are said and unsaid. But something that I thought was really interesting was the juxtaposition of the Fed chair giving a press conference within 5 minutes of Geoffrey Hinton having finished his talk at the MIT conference and expressing a lot of angst about the pace with which artificial intelligence is improving and the dire potential consequences if it's not managed appropriately. But I think this just very clearly highlighted to me again the huge difference in terms of the technological cycle and the interest rate cycle. Because when they're aligned, then technology shares tend to do exceptionally well. When they're not aligned, then it's the best capitalized companies, those with a clear vision of where cash flow comes from, are the ones that are going to do best, and the rest are going to have a hard time sourcing capital. Now, 10-year yields are compressing. So that's basically pricing in the scope that inflationary pressures are not going to be problematic in the future, even if they're still stubbornly high in the short term. Now, it's, I think, especially interesting that Jerome Powell today appeared to be bemused that unemployment hadn't risen more. Even though job openings have come down, hiring is still reasonably strong in some parts of the market, less so in others. But then the yield curve spread, the difference between the 10-year and the 3-month, continues to decline. It's down now to 183 in the negative, and that's a really significant inversion of the yield curve. And this particular version of the yield curve has been inverted now since October. And it is, I think, most particularly worth highlighting that it is usually as the yield curve is continuing to hit new lows that the stock market does fine. It's only when central banks begin to take fright at the pace with which economic activity is contracting, and that inflationary pressures suddenly turn into deflationary pressures, that they start aggressively cutting interest rates and the yield curve spread starts marching higher. With the jump in the 3-month yield today, that's basically pricing in today's interest rate hike. It's up to 3.19%. And we've seen that there's been a tendency to wait until the very last moment or just past it to raise the yield on the 3-month. So investors are really still very focused on the short term and not willing to buy anything longer than a 3-month maturity. And at the same time, putting a lot of money into money market funds, which is pretty normal for late in the cycle activity. But of course, if it is late in the cycle, well, then that also means that there's going to be an end of the cycle. And that implies that unemployment will rise. So it's not, I think it's not so much a factor that just because there hasn't been an uptick in unemployment yet, that it won't happen. And The Fed chair was also just very clearly saying in plain English, he knows that it is not historical precedent that you can raise rates this quickly and restrict credit in such an aggressive manner and not have a recession. But he hopes that there won't be a recession, or that if there is one, it'll be comparatively mild. But we continue to see downward pressure on the banking sector, and the regional banks index was in another new closing low in here today. So we've had quite a bit of variability, and I think that we are seeing a little bit of there's an attempt at least to try and differentiate between some of the undercapitalized banks and those that still have adequate capital. There's a statistic floating around that it's upwards of 50% of banks are potentially insolvent. So obviously that's bad news. The good news is that there are half of banks are not insolvent, and they have all sold off aggressively, which means that there will be buying opportunities in at least half of those banks. And then even then, there will probably be some solid buying opportunities in some of those that are technically insolvent, because there's absolutely no way that the US government is going to allow half of the entire banking sector to go bust. Most particularly, JP Morgan can't afford to buy them all. Now, what this is also helping to highlight is that liquidity conditions are tightening. So the potential is that the Federal Reserve will have to start cutting rates eventually. Now, the dollar index is pricing that in. So the dollar index was down today, continuing to pressure the lows, and still coming back down to test this psychological 100 level. That was an area of resistance between 2015 and 2021, and now it's coming back into the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And if the dollar breaks down through this level, which I think is the most likely scenario, well, then that will be a major break of trend. It will, I think, be clear confirmation that we are back in a dollar bear environment that is potentially medium term in nature. And that is also why gold prices continue to rebound. So gold was up another $14 today, securing the move above the 2000 level. This has been a very mild consolidation in the region of the upper side of the 3-year range, and it looks really quite well supported following about 6 weeks of doing not much of anything. So this is a longer period of time where it has held a psychologically important level. And if the dollar breaks down, then gold is going to break on the upside. With interest rates starting to come back down, then I think what investors will be paying attention to is the real rate environment. So gold tends to do best when the dollar is weak and negative real interest rates are getting more negative. So all the way through from late 2021 until the beginning, or the I guess the end of 2022, we saw that negative real interest rates moved from negative to positive, and with that aggressive pace of interest rate hikes. But on a constant maturity basis, that pace of appreciation stopped at the end of last year. Gold has since started to do better. If this index breaks on the downside, it will lend further credence to the view that gold is going to be one of the go-to assets to protect one's wealth in a bear market environment for the dollar, because what it implies is that we are moving into a period of financial repression, that the Federal Reserve may not be afforded the luxury of waiting until inflation comes back down all the way to 2%, that they may in fact be presented with economic surprises. Now, we have definitely seen stress in the banking sector, and that also means that credit conditions are tightening. We know that money supply is negative for the first time in decades, and we also know that they've raised interest rates 500 basis points in less than a year. So there are lots of tightening measures underway, and that is going to have a knock-on effect on the wider economy. But because of the pandemic savings, consumers have more cash and they're spending it, and that's sustaining the economic expansion that companies are still doing rather well. But I think what we are definitely seeing in the stock market is a winnowing. So, for example, Home Depot was one of the big beneficiaries of home renovations during the pandemic, and then it peaked at the end of 2021, came right back to the 1,000-day moving average, bobbed around a bit, and now it looks like it's starting to roll over. Now, when we think about some of the winners in the pharmaceutical sector, you've got companies like Eli Lilly, which have really accelerated higher and are doing so purely on the basis of new products that meet and are that address an unmet need, within the pharmaceutical sector. So, obesity drugs, for example. But then you have other companies that are not making their sales targets, and they are being severely punished. So AbbVie had this huge downward dynamic last week and is in negative territory again in here today. And this is a type 2 topping characteristic. We have very clear downward dynamic moves within the range. There is ample potential that it could break down and return to test the 1,000-day moving average in very swift order. Then also, we have, for example, Amgen, and really not an encouraging pattern. And having failed to sustain the breakout in November of last year, it's now back in the region of the lower side of the range, and it hasn't failed to find support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average at any point in the last decade. So, if it breaks lower, this is going to be a really significant event, and it will very clearly confirm the break of trend. But the clear bullish, excuse me, the clear bearish signal was the failed upside break in the first place. So this winnowing effect means that the winners are still doing reasonably well, and the any company that is not a winner is rolling over. So the advanced decline line for the NYSE securities has begun to roll over. Now, we still have a sequence of higher reaction lows, but that's a lower high. And I think in a bear market, we give the benefit of the doubt to the lower highs. So we've had a good sized rebound since the low back in October, and it's looking increasingly likely that it is running out of steam. So the S&P 500 was in negative territory today, continuing to pull back from the 4,200 point level. It hasn't quite yet broken back below the 200-day moving average, but I think that that's an increasingly more likely scenario. And a good reason for that is that oil prices were down another few dollars in here today, and the energy sector has topping characteristics as well. That was a massive reaction against the prevailing trend in the middle of 2022. It rallied all the way back up to test the peak and failed, and then failed again at 700, and then came back to test the sequence of higher reaction lows. Then we had another lower rally high, and now it's coming back down in a dynamic manner. And there's a preponderance of downward dynamics within this range. So it's a type 2 top with right-hand extension. And that implies that the sequence of higher reaction lows that's been in place since March of 2000 is going to break. And it's being led lower by the oil price. So the Brent crude price is coming back down and testing the $70 level. And these are, I think, very significant moves. It's basically pricing in the same eventuality that the bond yield is, that global demand is narrowing and falling because global liquidity is tightening. And China's efforts to support its economy are more about sustaining the status quo than really doing anything to boost speculative interest. Now, the CSI 300 has not moved since last week, and it's going to open tomorrow. So then the H share index in Hong Kong has reopened, and it was down over 1% in here today and continuing to experience resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average. Now, it's the luxury goods companies and some of the hotel companies have been the primary vehicle investors have used to bet on China's reopening, and LVMH is still pushing on the upside. So this is a good example of the winnowing effect, or what we might consider is premiumization, because both Hermes and LVMH are still doing very well, and then Kering has rolled over and hasn't been able to push on to new highs, and it is struggling to hold in the region of the 200-day moving average. So we're seeing a lot of this in various different sectors. And then let's just pay attention to the fact that it was the largest companies in the world were those that rebounded best. And Apple, as another one of those premium plays, is still holding on here, but it is now coming back in to test that sequence of lower rally highs. So now the big question is it going to be able to sustain the move on the upside when global growth is slowing down and is selling rather expensive products? It's not like they're selling one product to every 1,000 people. Apple is trying to sell a new product to most people most of the time. So they are dependent more on a broad spectrum approach rather than a pure premiumization approach. Then Microsoft is, or has at least been rewarded for taking a very foot forward way of thinking about artificial intelligence. There's a lot of I think there's a lot of confusion out there right now. A lot of the big data applications that have been in development for years continue to get better. And there was a lot of that priced into markets a few years ago, and then people basically forgot about it. And it's with the release of very large language models like ChatGPT 3 and 4, where there's been a refocus on the potential of the sector. And the good thing about, or I guess the most unique factor about any kind of artificial intelligence system is that it does take them a long time to learn, and the speed with which they're learning is improving. But the most important point is that once they've been taught something, then it's a copy and paste to the next iteration. So that means that the pace of learning can continue, and it's not like a human being where it takes decades to develop a core competency and then decades to teach someone else. And that, I think, is the thing that most people are worried about, that the pace of innovation within artificial intelligence is something that is accelerating. It's going to continue to accelerate, and we will go through periods of time where it becomes monetized and when it doesn't. The clear routes to monetization rely very much on clean data. So where you have clean data is going to be within the scientific sphere, in biotechnology, in chemistry, in material science. There's lots of data, very well organized, and that is a very clear end use potential for artificial intelligence. So finding the best candidates for new molecules, new drugs, finding the best candidates for materials science, and then also finding the best places to drill in the mining sector or in the oil and gas sector. Those are all very good uses for artificial intelligence. I think that there is obviously the clear potential that it is going to be weaponized, and that artificial intelligence will be a significant factor in any future war, because there is obviously the potential for mechanization, and just simply dropping a container of drones into a country and letting them do whatever they want, that's obviously a very benign outcome from the perspective of an aggressor. And I think that is something that is probably going to be a factor or a feature in any future major conflict. And we are in a geopolitically tense environment. But applying an aggressive tone, I think there is a anthropomorphization of the artificial intelligence. And if they don't have the same innate needs and wants of a human being, we shouldn't just assume that they're going to develop them. Now, they could easily be programmed into them, but innately, they don't have innate wants, needs, or requirements other than power and data. So that would suggest that a lot of the hand-wringing is premature, but then, of course, you have the potential that they will be programmed and that they will be used by state or aggressors in a nefarious fashion, and that there will be an untold loss of life as a result of it. And then that will lead to some form of regulation at some point in the future. But this is not a near-term issue, and it may not happen at all, but it is certainly a potential outcome. Now, the evolution of large language models is something that is obviously a very clear and present issue right now. And it is going to have a material impact on busy work. And then, of course, there is the potential that it's going to have a reasoning factor in future. Now, with the pace of innovation, that reasoning and the ability to have second order thinking, third order thinking, that's obviously something that's in the future, but it isn't. But it is almost certainly going to occur, and that will further displace workers, and it will lend further power to AI. But what it will also enhance is data-driven decision making and remove some of the emotionality. But one thing that I think is most particularly true is that it's not going to obviate the ability of vested interests to influence policy. And if an AI comes up with an argument for what is the best way to educate children, and that doesn't gel with the needs, wants, or priorities of teachers' unions, well, it's simply not going to happen. And this is the reality of the world we live in. So I think it is one thing to look at what the potential is from an academic perspective or a commercial perspective, but then we also have to think about it in terms of the reality of social interaction, and where the biggest potential is in either busy work or in developing new technologies from large data sets. But one thing that all of those things have in common is lots of additional cash and credit. And in a tightening credit environment, what we're currently seeing is a winnowing of the winners from the losers, and that is narrowing breadth. And that is being sustained by the fact that interest rates have gone up quickly, and that the negative effects of tightening credit have not been felt in the real economy yet. But I do believe that it is only a question of time, and with yields starting to come back down, then it is inevitable that we're going to see a deeper process of consolidation in the stock market as well. I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.